Welcome to the Business of Show Business with me, Jamie Boddy. I'm joined by industry experts and up-and-coming creatives as we unpack the skills, stories, and side hustles behind the entertainment and creative industries. So if you are ready to thrive and not just survive in showbiz and the arts and culture sector, you're in the right place. Hey, today I am joined by West End and touring performer Alan Hawke, who has performed in shows such as Come From Away, Follies, and is currently appearing in The Great Gatsby musical at the London Coliseum. Today we're going to be talking about covering lead roles, the art of touring, and all things the business of show business. Surprise! How's it going?
Yeah, good. Really good, thank you.
How is The Great Gatsby musical going? I just keep seeing clips all over social. People are loving it. Are you loving it?
I love it. I am genuinely having the best time that I've probably had in a show for years, I would say. It's such a gift anyway to be doing a brand new musical, like an original London cast of a show, but the show itself is so unique in that it's an adaptation of a really old, well, the story's 100 years old.
Yeah.
This year. So then to have a story that is that old and yet give it a completely modern, fresh perspective. All original songs, like, yeah. The characters have all been fleshed out in a way that hasn't been done, I don't think, in previous iterations of, like, the films and things like that. Yeah. It's brilliant. And the show it feels like a big party. So even for us as a cast, it's just fun. We're encouraged to keep things different and fresh. Ooh. And don't just do exactly the same thing every night, because then it keeps everyone on their toes and keeps everyone kind of looking out for one another and responding properly to each other in a real life sort of situation. So it's I love it. Just having the best time.
Well, that's quite refreshing to hear, because sometimes when you're in a show, you're doing it 8 shows a week, sometimes more if it's a summer holiday, whatnot.
Yeah.
It's quite hard maybe to find that shiny new thing in it.
Oh,
so
yeah.
If that's encouraged in a safe environment, that probably gives you all chance to grow as performers as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what's nice is that even from the ensemble's perspective, that is very much encouraged as well. It's not as if that's just a privilege that is given to the people who say the most lines or spend the most time on stage. It's really every single person has been encouraged to bring what it is that they bring to their own lives onto the stage, which is rare, I think, that you're not sort of put into a box of, well, that's what that track does. That's what that track did on Broadway, so that's what you're going to do here.
I had a few friends who have been in the West End, and obviously they love it, so grateful, but they say sometimes it's not quite as artistically fulfilling when you go into a long-running show and that track is set, the costume's set, and don't get me wrong, they still love performing, but there's no wiggle room at all.
Yeah, and I think there's space for that, because obviously, if it's not broke, don't fix it. And there are shows that have been running for decades because they work, and they work as they are. So I understand why some creative teams like to keep things kind of visually and directorially similar to what the original production was. I now, especially having done a show like Gatsby, I just think you get a lot more out of your cast when you can give them ownership over what it is they're going to do for those 8 or more shows a week. Because people care more about it. They spend more time creating what it is they're going to do in the show and therefore take better care of it. And that goes for the swings and things like that as well. Like when they get to go on for someone's track, there's an expectation for them to bring what it is that they're going to bring to the track, rather than, well, that's what Alan does in the show, so that's what you have to do, which therefore kind of keeps everyone in a much more creative headspace rather than doing the paint by numbers acting, which, as I say, it has its place. I understand why that exists, but it's been really eye-opening doing a show like that where that isn't the case.
Yeah.
Because it's a much more joyful experience, I think.
What was the audition process like? Because I don't even perform that much now, but I knew so many people that were like, not to say even in the door for it, but they were like, I want to audition for it. Because it's obviously had quite the impact on Broadway, I think.
Yeah,
so a lot of performers wanted to be in it. So what was the audition process? Well,
it was efficient. From my memory, it was efficient.
It's a good word, efficient.
Yeah, it was really. But I think there's a lot of audition processes that are getting more like that now.
Yeah.
From my first call in for the show, I was just given material from the show, which is always nice because you're not stressing about what song is going to suit this genre of show. And I didn't have to really think about that. They just gave me a song from the show, gave me two scenes from the show. They knew what track I was obviously going to be going in for, which really helps. So then did that first round, came back and did a dance round, like a movement call, did my final, and then just had to wait. I was waiting a very long time to hear about Gatsby, actually.
How long?
I would say like 6 or 8 weeks.
Oh, that
it was a long time. Basically, they tried to wrap everything. Initially, they had said they were doing stuff really efficiently because they wanted it all wrapped up by Christmas just gone. And then the last off I heard before everything shut down for Christmas was basically just, you won't hear anything before Christmas. I knew of some people who'd had no's, and I knew of some people who'd had yes's. So no news was still kind of good news, maybe. Yeah. But then, interestingly, when everything reopened in the new year, the Spotlight had put out a breakdown for the track I was in for. So I was then like, oh, I've not got it.
Yeah.
And then a couple of weeks later, I had a phone call saying that there was actually an offer coming through. So it was a shock.
Yeah.
But, and I'd sort of pushed it out of my mind. So it was a weird sort of, I was really pleased that I'd got it, but I was also a bit like, oh, I sort of hadn't factored that in to my next year.
Yeah, you're like, you ruined my Christmas. I've been
waiting. Yeah, exactly. I'd sort of moved on from it. But it was nice to then, it was nice to just know then that I had that plan. And there was such a buzz around the auditions, I think, because of that, because people knew the show from Broadway and people kind of had an expectation of, and the cast that they'd had on Broadway was really impressive as well. So I think there was a level of, you knew what kind of caliber the show was going to be getting. And I sort of like found out, I was drip fed rumors about who had been cast in the principal, like London cast, while I was deciding whether I was going to do it or not. And like after the third name had popped up, I was like, yeah, I'm going to do that. Yeah, I'm definitely going to do that one.
I know nothing about football, but it sounds like, you know, when people are doing their fantasy football team and they're like, oh, that or personal play. Again, I know nothing about football.
But it really is. I remember thinking, like, when I found out who was in all the leading roles of it, I was just like, this is like a one-off concert cast. This is the sort of cast you'd get for one night in a theatre in London. And we've got people for this amazing summer run of The Great Gatsby. It's so impressive to get to see that and listen to it every night. Just such powerhouse performers.
Yeah. Speaking of impressive, your CV, I was like, getting repetitive strain injury. Obviously, you've played Lumiere in Beauty and the Beast. You were Andy Lee in Cover, Julian Marsh in 42nd Street. Those are some quite iconic roles. Uh-huh. What was it like jumping into those?
It's always an amazing process to like find out what your version of these really well-known characters is going to be. I mean, Beauty and the Beast was a nuts one, especially because you're sort of left in this world of like, how am I going to play a candlestick?
What's my motivation?
And it's hard because you've got such major boots to fill in, like in the original films and things like that, and then people who've played those roles along the way as they've been made into stage musicals. You're just sort of trying to navigate your way of finding your version whilst also wanting to be as good as previous versions, or at least be so different that you're not going to be compared to that particular person. It's an amazing process. And I think my biggest thing is, you know, like I say, I think trying to find what is about you and in your essence as a performer, what it is that's going to be your kind of channel through that character. Yeah. I think like things like Julian Marsh and things like that in 42nd Street, it's such a well-known character in a well-known show. And it's always done in a very particular kind of, it's usually done in a very particular kind of way.
Yeah.
And so for me, like covering a role like that, I just knew that if I were to go on, I can't do it like how I'd previously seen it done. So I had to sort of figure out, well, what have I done with my career? And and my, especially because that show is about theater, like what is it that I've done in my theater life that I can draw on to then make that my version of Julian. It's just such an it's always just such an exciting process to kind of figure out your route, and what it's that for me is the key, is finding that, like, that key pivotal thing that is in you that you can put into that character and then just flesh out from around that.
I think that's a really, like, nice, like, analytical way to almost look at it, and almost maybe for some people might help them if they're listening to think, oh, if they get overwhelmed quite easily, or when there's a mammoth part like that, when the possibilities are also endless, but it's been in existence. That's probably quite a nice way to think, you know what, let me just find that one little nugget, one thing, that one key in, and then it will develop from there.
And I think that's I think that is the thing. For example, when I stepped in to play the Beast on Beauty and the Beast for a while,
I'm done with being the candle now. Big boy.
It was, for me, it was finding, I had to find the human thing in him that then creates the rest of this character that everyone knows as a beast. Yeah. And for me, it was that when I was looking through the material and in the script, I felt like he only ever acts out in a vicious beast way when he's scared, and when he feels afraid of someone or something. So then that became my, like, key into that character, because for quite a lot of it, he is very human and very vulnerable, but then there's these situations in which the direction is he roars at this point, or he's, you know, we need you to be more kind of vicious at that point. And I was like, okay, so I now need to track back and figure out where's the point when he's become afraid, and then build to that point rather than just going from zero to big beast roar and exit the stage kind of thing. And it's little tiny things like that, but then once you find that little pinpoint, the rest of the show kind of goes, it like all falls into place.
Is that how you analyze maybe auditions? If you're getting sides through, do you always try and find that little spark of Alan in there?
Yeah. Because I think especially for an audition, because you've got maybe 30 seconds worth of a scene to be able to bring something to the table. I think it's finding the key choice moments of that side where you can bring what you have deduced as the key elements of that character, pop those into that side, and whether it's an emotional thing or it's a character trait or just something that is your in, I think that's the most important thing. If it's the voice, is it a laugh, is it you know, on that particular line, that's when there's an emotional shift, and what is the motivation behind that emotional shift, things like that, I think become the things that a panel will be able to go, ah, they've thought about that.
Yeah.
And I think that when you've only got a short amount of time, you need to just find two or three key moments to just go, I've considered this. Do you agree with my choices? Can they direct you in a different way? Or I think that's my probably biggest kind of audition side.
And that's what we mean by making a choice. I think we say that all the time, especially when you're working with graduates, and we say, you know, make a choice. And your choice, the part of you found that script, could be very different than what I find in that script. Yeah. So there's no one right or wrong, but it's making that choice and it's going with it.
I always say that to any students that I've worked with. I always say there are no wrong choices. Yeah. Some choices are better than others, but there's never a wrong choice. And especially if you can justify it, then it can't be wrong, because you've got to that process. That's what a director is there for, is to direct you in the way of what their vision of a character is, or what their vision of the show is. But by you making a choice about it, shows them that you've got that ability.
As a huge Disney fan yourself, did you love when you got that offer for Beauty and the Beast? Were you like, yes?
Yeah. It was just, it's always been such a dream to be able to be a part of that Disney family in a way. And especially my initial offer for the job was to play the baker. And
a good, sensible role, classic role.
Classic role. Marie, the baguette, hurry up. it was that, and to be the first cover Beast, first cover Lumiere, and first cover Gaston. So all the thought of getting to play all of those amazing, like, childhood icon roles,
yeah,
was just nuts. And it became the job that then I ended up walking away from the job with two principal credits on my CV, purely because of taking over for the Beast for a little while and then taking over from Gavin Lee once he went back to America as Lumiere. It just became this amazing opportunity to gain that experience of being able to be in a leading role in a show and to find my route through those principal characters and things like that. And it was amazing. And to just there's something about being in a Disney musical that is just...
Yeah.
It's just magical. They know what they're doing.
Yeah, they're doing right, haven't they? Yeah. You're also no stranger to touring. You love a tour.
I love a tour.
And obviously on Come From Away, you were a resident director and standby. Mm-hmm. So that's extra responsibility as well.
Yeah.
First of all, though, touring life. What is it really like? Because touring is a great way to not only see the country, but you save money.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It's also quite hard sometimes because you're finding digs. So let's pull back the curtain. What is touring life like?
I think those points are all very true. I think the difference for me, the big difference is UK, touring the UK at the minute is a weird system in my mind, because it's kind of the only job that I know of where you would be asked to move around the country for your work and not be provided with accommodation. There's a big discussion going on about it at the minute. I understand that with equity and within the industry, because when you do an international tour you are put up in accommodation, and because you're then given like a per diem and things like that, you can save some money on that if you live within the means of your daily spending money. The difference being then on a UK tour you are given a touring allowance to find your accommodation and things, but the problem has always been that as theatrical landlords find out how much the touring allowance is, they raise the rate of rent, and the touring allowance is there to be able to get our accommodation and be able to provide us with food. And because sometimes you'll get to your digs and your landlady isn't happy with you using the kitchen, or you get to your digs and you don't want to use the kitchen because it's not to a standard that you would necessarily keep your own home. So it's UK touring at the minute is more difficult, I think. And then there needs to be some thought into how to better protect companies that are going on tour with things like digs and even just safety, being in cities you don't know and you aren't aware of the transport network, you aren't aware of how far away your digs might be from that theatre. And whereas international touring, at least the company has control of how far are you going to keep the company away from the theatre, or how are you going to provide the transport to get from the accommodation to the theatre. Don't get me wrong, I love a tour. I actually do really enjoy touring.
Can't get them off them.
Because the difference that what I do like about touring is that when you work in the West End, quite often you've got your base in London and you kind of just want to go home at the end of the night because it's your home and you've got all your home comforts there. You know what you're going home to. You can see your friends. Whereas when you are on tour, there's a lot more of a kind of camaraderie of the company kind of, you all know each other. So you spend a lot more time together. You arrange to do more things as a company. You tend to connect more with people. So it really does have its perks. And I got to see some amazing places. Yeah. Like that is one of the big things for me. I was lucky on my last tour where I was driving between most of my venues on while I was doing Come From Away. And so I had this ability to then, between venues, if I chose to, I could kind of spend the 2 days off between venues going, well, I'm not going to just drive straight to the next venue. I'm going to go kind of via here and have a little road trip and see different places. And that was really lovely because then I had some time that was just for me and getting outdoors for a while, and it has its perks.
Yeah.
It's like everything. It's like you can find the bright side in it.
Well, yeah, and there's some people that I know that they love tours, they love cruise ships because they're not paying rent, they've got those per diems.
Yeah.
But then I know for some people, touring is not for them.
Yeah.
Because touring can be as little as 3 days to a week to like a 3 month set down. Yeah. So I think it's good that we kind of see that there are pros and cons to it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think touring is especially something that it depends where you are at in your life.
Yeah.
Because Come From Away was a classic example, actually, because I previously had done a lot more kind of dance-based musicals. And they tend to then have a younger cast because your ensemble are going to be dancers.
Yeah.
So then doing Come From Away had a much kind of older average age of the cast. But it also meant then we had parents who were on the tour, right. their kids are back home, and or people tend to have partners or things like that. Yeah. So people were more settled in their life by that age. And so touring came with a completely new set of challenges for a lot of people, like not being there for their kids, you know, dance show or for sports day, or and having that very limited time off to then get you home straight after the show on a Saturday evening. You've then kind of got Sunday, a bit of Monday before you're heading back off on tour. And for a lot of people then, especially if they had kids, it's like they go home, they have Sunday, which is all manic and doing stuff as a family. And then they kind of get up early, do the school run, and then they're back on the road to go on tour. So they don't really get a day off either. So it was a lot. It was a lot for people.
Yeah, it's that elusive work-life balance. Yeah, wherever you are in your life, it is hard sometimes.
And I think that's a big way up of when you're accepting a job, is like you have to really think hard about whether it's the right thing to be doing at that stage in your life.
And on that note, I think one of the things I've loved seeing lately on your social media as well is some of your industry insight videos whilst you're in The Great Gatsby. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's really... It's helpful advice that we don't always hear, because I think this industry, we love it. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly hard, but we always... it's so easy to romanticize, isn't it, our industry?
Oh, yeah.
It needs that. But I think some of the videos you've shared lately about... Actually, are you doing that job because you want to do it and it fulfills something in you? Or are you doing that job because you think the industry wants you to do it?
Yeah.
So talk to me a bit more about that. And is that something that's maybe become more clear as your career's gone on? Or is that something you've kind of always had?
No, definitely not. I mean, I've been doing this for 15 years now since I graduated. And it's only been in the last like 2 or 3 years that I've really started to think about what it is I want to do and what direction I want my career to go in. And because I think for a lot of the beginning of my career, I went through a training system that I was taught to be really grateful for any opportunity that comes up. And therefore if a job offer came in, I would take it because it was a job. Yeah. And it wasn't until I switched agents a few years ago now. And I remember having a discussion with my current agent where he was sort of saying, like, have you ever said no to a job? And I was like, unless there's been like a choice between two jobs, then no. And he was like, well, that's interesting, because it just shows that the opportunities have dictated your career rather than you choosing what it is you want to do. And ever since that conversation, I've started to be a lot more choosy about what I accept to go in for an audition for and what job I eventually take if an offer comes through, and really kind of thinking about the big thing that came off the back of my little video about, are you taking that job because it's what you really want to do, or is it because everyone else is auditioning for that show right now? I have a lot of conversations with my friends and things about you have to keep your ego in check. I think particularly as performers, because we put ourselves on the line as our product. So it's really easy to take things personally. It's really easy to get carried away in your ego can really start to dictate what it is you are choosing to do. And even silly things, like I'll be in for an audition and then I find out that this XY performer is also in for that role. And suddenly I'll be like, well, I've got to get it. And you just think, well, you didn't necessarily care about it as much until you found out that other person is also in for it. So maybe just take a second, chill out about it, do what it is you're going to do in the room. And if you get it, great. If they get it, congratulations. Because it actually makes no odds to you. It's just keeping that ego kind of at bay every now and again. Yeah.
Absolutely love what you said there, because I'm always talking to students about how you are a product, and some people will buy into the skills you have, some won't, and you really need to identify what you are selling. So I think that's amazing what you said there, and that's the thing. I think we sometimes we chase jobs because we think we're meant to.
And yeah, definitely.
There was another piece of advice you gave in one of your videos, which was great, about like your trifecta of what is almost your checklist now on why you should pick a job. So what is your trifecta?
It was funny because since I put the video up, a few people sort of commented and they were like, I was always taught about the three C's or like the three P's. And I was like, that is a much better way of putting it. but mine doesn't have a catchy slogan. I've just always said that there's three things for me that a job offer has to tick two of them. Otherwise, it's not worth doing the job. And it is it going to professionally advance you and creatively advance you? Like, is it a creative team that you have always wanted to work with and a director that you've always wanted to collaborate with? Or is it a show that you've loved forever? Financially, is it going to be beneficial to you? I.e., is the wage going to be enough for you to live on and walk away from the job with something to show for it? Because that's a big thing, I think, as well, is that people take on jobs where the pay is all right, but by the time you're paying for your accommodation, be it on tour or in London, you're paying rent and things like that, or paying towards your mortgage, you can walk away from a job actually with not a huge amount to show for it. And is it going to fit your lifestyle? Like, are they going to give you the NAs to go to your sister's wedding, or is it going to allow you enough time to see your kids on the weekend, or are you going to get to see enough of your partner to make sure your relationship is still thriving? And if a job, even if a job is just one of those things, because I always use money as the example, like you could be being paid a fortune and it's the best money you've ever been on, but you don't see anyone and you're exhausted because the schedule's awful and you're falling out with your friends because you've not seen anyone. Or your sister's not speaking to you because you can't come to a wedding. And then professionally, it's not necessarily a show that you care about. So even when you're at work, you're bored or you're not enjoying yourself. Even walking away with all that money is not going to be worth it in the long run. And the same with the other two. If it's just one of those things, it's not worth doing the job. And I think that has taken me a long time to accept that. Because as I say, you're trained to be in a position of being grateful for the offer to come in. I always think as well, and especially what I've learned over time is that, for example, I just went through a process like that where I was kept waiting for a long time as to whether I was going to be offered the job or not. And then you get the job offer and you're being pushed very quickly to give an answer. And I always just think, you've got time. You've got time to think about it. It's not, none of those things are things that you should rush into a decision about, unless it's the job offer of a dream and you're like, great, that's everything I wanted from it, from the get-go, on paper, on the initial offer. I just think, like, take your time, think about it, and really think about how it's going to serve you, your career, and your life before you just kind of jump straight into the job.
Yeah, because we are in an industry, in the arts, where quite often the power is perceived in other places. Who has the purse strings? Mm-hmm. Who's the casting director? Mm-hmm. Who's the TV exec?
Yeah.
But in those moments when you can have the power,
yeah,
you should sit in it, not to like to gloat, but what I mean is that actually take a beat to be like, as you said, does it line up with this, this, and this? Like, don't feel pressured, because then what are you saying yes to now might mean you're saying no to something you really want further down the line.
Yeah, and I think actually you've touched on something that I also find really important, because I feel like in recent, probably even months, it's from doing Gatsby and working on a process that has felt truly collaborative within the room, that has become my big thing on a job, is I'm not as interested anymore in doing the carbon copy. You stand on that number and you say the words like this. Because for any creative team, I want to know that you're interested in collaborating with me as a performer and as an actor. I want to know that you've looked at my CV and you know what I can do, you know what I'm capable of, you know the potential that we might have to be able to bring something really great to this track or this role. And And I think that's why I also think like that it, you should take time over those decisions, because, you know, as I say, financially, lifestyle wise and creatively, it has to be the right thing. And that, that buzzword of collaboration has been coming up to me a lot recently, where I'm like, I want to work in rooms that feel like we're working together on this, and that it isn't that the director has all the power in that room, or that choreographer has all the power in that room, or the casting, or the producers, or it should, theatre is about a team of people. It's not, and you know, it's not even about the people who are on stage even. It's everybody in that building is going to be working together to produce this amazing product for an audience. And if anyone holds too many of the shots, it's going to fall apart, because that's not how theatre as an industry can work.
Yeah, and a lot of the shows you've been on, you have covered roles, you've been standby resident director and Come From Away. That in itself is a completely different skill set.
What
makes a good swing or a cover or a standby? Because it's not for everyone.
No, I agree. And I, one of the things I've not done in my career is been a swing, because for me, I know that that wouldn't be, I would not be good at that in my brain. Because for some reason, understudying and being a swing seem to be two completely different parts of my brain. I think a good cover, swing, understudy, I would say is the main thing is about doing your homework. I've always, there's not been one job other than Gatsby where I wasn't on for my cover before I'd finished the first cover rehearsals. That's just always been the way of it, because I think the lead up to opening a show is always really busy, and all of the principals, all of the whole company are throwing all of their energy at getting the show open, and marry that up with coming out of a busy tech period. You go through all your previews. You're also filming the EPK. You're doing all the promotional shots. Everyone's going on this morning to promote the show. It's all the extra stuff that people don't factor in. And then suddenly the show's open and everyone gets sick because your body just like collapses into this ordinary 8-show-a-week routine. So there's never, ever been a point where I've not been thrown in at the deep end, really. And so I've learned over time that like from day one in the rehearsal room, just observe stuff, just do whatever it is you can to get that cover role under your belt, learn the lines, like go through the script whenever you've got a chance. Make notes of the blocking, even if it's just rough, so you've got a rough idea of where people are. There's a huge amount of pressure, I think, on covers in recent times, especially because we see a lot more now that shows close because they've not got enough people in the building. Mm-hmm. There's not enough cover in the building. And there's this real pressure on covers, I think, to be like performance ready from the get-go. And I do believe that there's an element of you can make yourself prepared, but you are within your rights to say like, I don't feel safe to go on without any kind of rehearsal here. But I think when you can take on as much of that information as possible, you can at least know that in those situations, you have done everything within your power. I've done my job to learn what I can. There's just elements of this which I can't do that safely without being teched into the show, or I can't, you know, I'd be putting that person at risk if I try to do that without rehearsing with them. But that's my, that's probably my biggest thing, is just being as prepared as possible, and being flexible, and just knowing that you might have an entirely different interpretation of the role as a cover, and you are entitled to bring elements of that to how you're going to do the role, but there is always going to be an element of the direction of the show is like this, and or that particular actor needs a little bit more of this from you for them to also feel comfortable within their performance. You can't sort of go on and do it so differently that everyone else in the show is also having to adapt their show out of the normal parameters of that.
I'm bringing pyro on.
I'm gonna wear this instead. So there's it's being flexible, being prepared. My also big thing, as we spoke about ego, is I think as understudies, it's really easy. I love being an understudy because when you go on, you get quite a fuss made of you because it's different. And I do think that there's an element of your ego can kick into overdrive sometimes, because there will be people who are like, I actually prefer your version, or I love the way you sing that, or, you know, it sounds even better than so-and-so doing it. And I think particularly in the world of social media, where people can put that view out there straight away.
Yeah, good or bad.
The bootlegs of you will be on before you've even finished the show. And I think there's an element then of your ego can take over a little bit, where you start to maybe think like, oh, maybe I am better than that person. And you may well be. That may well be the case. But I just think keeping your own ego at bay and just saying, if I was the best person to play that role, I'd be playing the role. And unequivocally, I would have walked in that room and they would have gone, I don't care if we've got that person lined up for it. That is our lead. I think understanding that is the job you signed up for. You're there to be an understudy. You're there to maybe do your ensemble track and do your understudy track when that opportunity comes up. You have to sit in that that was the decision you made by taking the job, was to be the understudy. So just sit content in that, do the work, do the process, do all of that stuff that then, and if you're sitting in it miserable because you want to be playing the lead, you just need to take that into your next opportunity. And if the next opportunity that comes up is another understudy job, you need to just say, I know that that's not going to work for me because I won't be happy, so I'm not going to take that job, and I'm only going to start auditioning for lead.
Yeah, again, taking that power back or control the controllables.
Yeah.
This has been great. Before I let you go, I've got a quick lightning round called Lights, Questions, Action.
Oh gosh.
Yes, and I'm just going to say stuff. It's anything, and you're not going to reply. Uh-huh. Let's go. It's
okay. Quick.
See what happens. Okay. First question. If the cast of Great Gatsby the Musical had a party, who would be the first one on the dance floor?
On the dance floor? Jemele. Or Rachel Tucker.
Got the moves.
I would say, yeah. Yeah.
She's partying. second one. Favourite role you've ever played?
Favourite role I've ever played? Gaston.
One role you would love to play?
One role I'd love to play? Oh, God. The Baker in Into the Woods.
I was say Baker and
Baker and Beauty and the Beast.
He loves anything with bacon.
I've done it. I've achieved my dream.
One line from a show you'll never forget, or that you can always quote.
In Gatsby.
Yeah, any show you've done, your favorite one line.
Oh God, my favorite line. I don't want to get it wrong now. In 42nd Street, Peggy says, "Julia Marshall just called her a speck of dust on that stage." And she says, but put all those specks together and you have something alive and beautiful that can reach out to thousands of people we've never seen before. And then she leaves the stage saying that she's content because she's a speck of dust in his show. I just love that. I think that's such a stagey thing, but that's my like thing of every speck of dust within that whole building creates this amazing piece of magic for people. And that's something that I just try to keep in my mind then on any show.
/ you want to play Peggy.
And Peggy Sawyer, yeah, dream role.
Most challenging number you've ever danced?
The ballet in American in Paris at the end of the show.
Best advice you never took?
That I didn't have a dancer's body. I just had an ordinary person's body.
Oh, really? I hate them. What is your go-to audition song?
All I Care About Is Love from Chicago.
Most overused audition song you hear?
I feel like it's changed a lot over recent years. I hear things that I don't hear so often. On the Street Where You Live.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah.
Also in my rep.
Don't get me wrong.
I can't sing.
Got me a few jobs.
If an actor played you in a movie, who would it be? What actor would play you? It could be anyone. It could be Meryl Streep.
Andrew Garfield.
Yeah.
I would go for.
I can see that.
Yeah.
And last question. You've just obviously been on a podcast. Are you someone who likes to leave podcast length voice notes or text messages?
I like to a lot. So I'm a voice noter.
Just to get it all
a
out
long
there.
Voice note. Yeah. I apologize.
Well, that's all. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Loved it. And has now got to rush off to do a show. So wherever you tune in or watch, make sure you leave your comments and we'll see you back next time.